Well, as you all know, our nation has just undergone one of the most divided seasons that I can remember, at least in my lifetime. So, what, 25 years or so. It is a time where so many things can be known about somebody, or at least we think so many things can be known about somebody by just the way that they answer certain questions. I mean, do you support the mask mandate? I mean, how you answer that question for many folks answers so many other questions that the conversation doesn't even need to go on. Or do you follow the science? How you answer that question often does the same. Was the election stolen? And so on and so on. I mean, we saw just weeks ago citizens of our own nation forcibly entering the Capitol because of their deeply held beliefs about answers to that question and others very similar to it. And just yesterday, we saw the conclusion of the trial against our former president and where he was acquitted of charges concerning the incitement of that riot. So why do I bring this up? I mean, especially since I know these questions bring no small amount of animus, and we don't come to church to be thrown right back into the same stuff we're trying to escape from all week. Well, I bring it up because it's those sort of deep feelings and division that drives our text forward this morning. And so what I want us to see first this morning is the setting the trap. Setting the trap. In today's text, we find the leadership of Israel after hearing the parable of the tenants and knowing that it was about them seeking to trap Jesus by his own words because they desire, ultimately, his downfall and destruction. And because they don't want to sully themselves by either showing public resistance to this teacher who the people love, or because they don't want to be embarrassed by him if he happens to answer them in a way that is unsuiting to their purposes, they send spies to do their duty for them. You know these kind of brave people who have all sorts of concerns, but then they send other emissaries on their way, just in case things don't work out the way they had hoped. And so folks were sent to watch Jesus, and then to feign sincerity, and ultimately after feigning sincerity, to challenge him with a question that would hopefully be his undoing. It is interesting that they hope to use his noble reputation against him. They think, well, if he's honest and he's really this teacher and everyone thinks so, then great, he'll answer honestly, and if he answers honestly, then he's a dead man. You're a teacher who's sincere. You say what you mean. You direct the people to walk in the way of God, and since that's the case, tell us honestly the truth. What do you think about this question? Well, why is it that they think that that sort of approach will win for them? What is it they're attempting to do? I mean, Luke tells us twice that they're seeking to trap him. He ends his text by saying they couldn't trap him. You must understand not only the magnitude of the question, but how much history leads into this particular question that they're bringing to Jesus. I mean, if you think our times are tough, or if you think, a red hat sets off all sorts of sirens in our day, the things that would trigger people in this day were just as front and center, if not more so. And the question they're bringing to Jesus is going to send off all of the alarm bells and let everyone know where Jesus stands. By him answering this question, he'll have answered so many other questions, there'll be nothing left to talk about. You see, to understand all that's happening here, you need to know the story of two men named Judas, neither of which are the ones from the Bible. But they're famous in the history of Israel. These two men, interestingly enough, were both known for storming the Capitol, stirring up insurrection, and seeking governmental overthrow based on righteous reasoning. Yeah, I'm not kidding. This is all before our time. The first, Judas the Sledgehammer, was a revolutionary during the mid-100s BC, so during the time of the rule of Greece, when Israel was under that leadership at the time. This particular man led an insurrection. He came and cleansed the temple as a sign that the Gentiles had defiled it by their presence. He demanded that people no longer pay taxes to Greece. And through this, mini insurrection and raising up of an army, he eventually did get Greece to succumb to him, but only once he joined forces with the Roman government, this one that he thought might not do the exact same thing that the former government had done to them. Well, Judas was a hero of the people. He had at least overthrown one government that they felt was totalitarian and polluting their religious system. And so in due time, there was another Judas who was raised up who was actually named after the first one. His parents clearly raised him with a kind of zeal for these sorts of things to fight for the nation against foreign oppressors. And when Jesus was about 5 years old, so, you know, Jesus is in kindergarten, there's this other Judas who is in adulthood raising up another sort of insurrection in the land of Israel. This other Judas called all the Jews of his time to refuse to pay taxes to Rome. And not just any tax, he was calling them to refuse this exact tax that they're asking Jesus about. There was all sort of taxes that the Jews paid. They paid all sort of temple taxes, depending on, you know, what was required of them in that particular year. There were all sorts of tithes that went to the priesthood. But there were also poll taxes that were kind of regional, what your particular tax collector would, you know, try to get from you, to garner from you. But there was also this one tax that everyone that lived under the Roman rule paid, and it was the poll tax. It was the poll tax. It was one denarius per person, and it was a way for Rome to know basically how large their dominion was, and it was also a way for everyone to know as they were paying it whose dominion they were under. This Judas would eventually ride into Jerusalem being hailed as the Messiah. He would once again cleanse the temple like his namesake, and he declared a new kingdom that was under God's reign alone. And so he comes in on his steed and he says, God's kingdom is here. We will no longer submit to Rome. And that was all right before Rome had him executed for insurrection. That sort of thing can really dampen the spirits of a movement, and so the movement died down, but not without a party tying themselves to this man, the Zealot, and you see them in Scripture. Judas the Zealot had those who followed him, those who wanted the physical and revolutionary overthrow of the Roman government. And so it's into this context that Jesus, who has just ridden into Jerusalem, been hailed the Messiah, has cleansed the temple, is now asked this question: should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? You see, the drama over this tax had not subsided. This tax, a tax that required every man to be counted and to give one day's wage a year to Rome, was not opposed primarily because of the size of the tax. There were actually larger taxes than this one. Can you imagine if your federal tax was just one day's wage? And that was all that was required of you, you know, we'd all jump for joy. It's not the price tag on the tax. It's the symbolism of the tax that's the problem. It's what it's saying about who Rome is and who you are. Maybe you remember the story. You hear it every year, at least the King James Version tells it like this, that, you know, there was a decree sent out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. Well, why'd they have to be registered? For this tax. So that Caesar could know everyone that was under his rule and also inform them as they're handing over their denarius that they are subjugated to the rule of this particular emperor. Tertullian called it a sign of slavery. I mean, you see the setup the question gives? The people love Jesus. And that, of course, is a threat to these leaders of Israel. They don't like the fact that the people are starting to gather around this messianic sort of figure and really starting to buy into what he's saying. You know, the crowds are gathering, they're hailing him, the King of the Jews, just in the chapter previous. And so the leadership of Israel has no liking for that because, of course, if his power increases in their minds, that must mean that their influence and power will decrease. But the people also follow folks like the Pharisees, people who want to stand up against the government overreach that Rome is employing upon these people. I mean, God owns us. not Caesar, they were rightly taught in their catechism classes all growing up. So if Jesus is really the people's Messiah, he will surely side with the people, right? He will also agree that paying taxes to Rome is this overreach of authority, and it'll be his way to show that he is indeed a revolutionary, if not a revolutionary, at least so pro-Israel that he's not going to be bound under this false flag of Rome. And if he doesn't say that, he will lose the people. But of course, if he does, if he agrees that they shouldn't pay taxes, he won't lose the people, he'll just lose his head, which is why the leadership thinks this is perfect. Either he's going to lose his following, the following that we used to have, or he's going to lose his life. So there's more than one way to skin a cat. If he dies, he dies. And so this question is a setup that seems like he cannot win. And they feel that they have put this man, you know, in the proverbial checkmate. So this really is an early attempt at our current way of cancel culture. You know, the enemies don't care how Christ gets canceled as long as he gets canceled and is no longer a threat to what they want. And so if that is the setting of the trap, you'll notice the next thing we see is showing the money. Jesus' response is both subtle and quite beautiful. He simply says, well, bring me a coin. And so someone coughs one up. They give him a denarius. It's this Roman coin, silver. And on this Roman coin is, of course, an imprint of the emperor. And on the back of it is an imprint, what we believe is, of his mother. But the front reads on this coin, son of the divine Augustus. And on the back it reads, high priest or chief priest. So you'll see that the coin itself shouted very loudly concerning the problem at hand. It spoke without shame, not just about Roman authority, this absolute civil authority that Caesar claimed, but also it spoke of religious authority, this religious claim that he was making, that he was the great Lord and the chief priest. It was really blasphemous in the mind of the Israelite. How can we even trade in this kind of coinage when it presents to us a false god under a false title in a land that is owned by the God of Israel? I mean, think about how humiliating that would be for a Jewish citizen. Not only to be reminded day after day of foreign domination, but to handle blasphemous claims in your normal affairs just as you simply trade money. It's politically humiliating, religiously infuriating. What was a conscientious Jew to do in this situation? If you love Torah and you hate idolatry and you hate all false claims about God, it seems obvious, doesn't it? Jesus is going to have to side with the zealots before him and the Pharisees of his day. I mean, the logic is clear. It blasphemes. We shouldn't have to acknowledge Caesar as Lord. Plus, what will Rome even use this money for? I mean, think of the things that Rome does with the taxes they collect from the Jewish people. As one author rightly notes, I mean, the nails that drive through the hands of Christ on the cross are likely purchased with tax money contributed by all those that Rome sits over. But all sorts of atrocity and war and expansion of the kingdom is funded through these public gifts that are forced on these people. And you see how it could easily be argued and how it seems so much more spiritual to hold this position, so much more biblical and clear than the one who says, I don't know, I just think we should pay taxes. That one would look like a compromiser or someone who just wasn't willing to stand for times of righteousness. But Jesus, of course, doesn't answer the way that our thinking might take us. And it's not because he's compromised or weak-wristed moderate who just doesn't want to, you know, get in the middle of things. They want him, of course, to be a zealot and a fundamentalist and to pigeonhole him in a particular way, mainly because they want him to die. But he wants to take them out of this particular conversation altogether and force them somewhere that most of us don't want to go. So he says, show me the denarius. They give it to him, and he says, whose picture is on it? To which they reply rightly, Caesar's picture. Tiberius Caesar's face is on the coin. And he says, well, then you should give Caesar's stuff back to him. Give him his just deserts. It is interesting. They say, should we gift our taxes to Caesar? He doesn't respond by saying, yes, give this gift back to him. He says, give him what he's owed or what he deserves or what is basically coming to him. It was also a way that the zealots used, where we're going to give Rome what's coming to them. Jesus used it to say, you should give them their taxes. That's what's coming to them. Definitely not a popular response, but then, of course, he responds by also saying, you should give to God what is God's. But what is God's? What is he trying to get them to consider? Well, what do we own that has God's image and inscription on it? Even as we read this morning in Genesis chapter 1, we were made in God's own image. He has inscribed his very law on our hearts. And so what Jesus is saying, look, you see this coin that you're all, worked up over? Why aren't you just as concerned about the fact that you bear the image and the inscription of God, but you have not given yourself freely to him? You haven't given what is owed to your maker, your very person, your whole self. You see, they want a nice answer to check the box. Who's good and who's bad and which side are you on? But of course, one wants him to answer one way because they want to keep power, the leaders of Israel. The other wants to keep their personal autonomy and freedom. They don't want to be bossed around by this other government, the people. But neither want God to own them completely. And it shows, by what they fight for and what they fret over. What they fight for and what they fret over. It's ironic, isn't it? They're mad about this supposed dirty money. Dirty money that they just happen to have when Jesus asks for one. I mean, it would be like someone protesting masks and then you asking to borrow theirs to go in the store and they have one on hand, right? It's one of those things that it's like, well, should we be using this money? Oh, here, borrow mine in order to give your illustration. It's just a sign that they're all dirty, that they're all complicit, that none in the story are innocent. To show themselves, they show themselves because they hold the very coin that they question in their own possession. But even more, they show themselves because God stands before them and they've yet to give themselves, to him without reservation and humility. They show their unwillingness to be holy gods because they resist God's given authority, both in government and in God's salvation authority. They resist the government, the Pharisees, and the people, in that they don't want to pay these taxes. They don't want to have to give up their personal autonomy in this way, or to say of themselves that they're under someone else's leadership. They don't want to give in to God's salvation. The leaders of the people don't want Jesus to be here. They want to be saved, but not in this way and by this one. I mean, one way we show we really give ourselves wholly to God is to trust his sovereign will in all things, even in human governments. I mean, part of what was so troubling about what happened on January 6th, not the protesting, which is our right according to our own rules of governance, but the attempt to overrun mere protest and to get into what we would consider riot or insurrection is because of what it says about God's sovereignty, not because of what it says about which party is in place. That God is the one who raises up governments and puts them down, and God is the one who gives authority, and it's not based on whether the authority itself is the exact one that you'd want to be ruled by. I mean, consider, at least your money says, in God we trust, whatever God that may be. Their money made it very clear that Caesar was Lord, And God didn't say, well, that's not a legitimate government, because look at the coinage they use. You know, you need to, you know, make sure that you overthrow it immediately. Instead, Jesus says, just give them back their money. It's theirs anyway. I mean, Paul will go on to make this same point under the same government in Romans 13. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God. And those that do exist have been instituted by God, including Rome at this current time. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of their own conscience. It is for this reason that you also pay taxes. What an interesting conclusion. For the authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. Paul just says, you know why you pay taxes? Because governments are always going to tax you. You were warned long ago when you asked for a king. Kings always do this stuff, right? They're going to get their piece of flesh from you, and that's what they... One, it's not wrong, depending on what they're being used on. And two, it's just what happens in authorities that rule in this current age. And God says, because I'm in charge of everything, and because I really own you wholly, it's okay if you submit to those who don't submit themselves to me wholly, because I have instituted them for these very purposes. Well, what do we see if that's them showing the money? Hopefully, in our conclusion, we see ourselves. The text makes plain, Christ makes plain, that what God's really concerned about is you giving him everything. He's not concerned about your tax bracket as much as he's concerned about whether you will honor him with your whole self. And if we owe him everything, think about how much we keep back for our own purposes. I mean, so now what? I mean, these men have shown themselves, because if God stands right before them, they haven't given themselves fully to God. They show themselves because they have this coin in their own purse that they want to feign some sort of outrage over. These who are worried about taxes, who desire a revolution, have failed to see exactly where the problem lies, at least the preeminent problem. They have been in revolt not against Rome, but against their Maker from the very first day. They've refused to pay him what he is owed. They've lived not wholly for him, but often wholly for themselves. And they're sitting here worried about taxes when there's something much bigger to be worried about. Brothers and sisters, we owe it all to God. And we have welched on that debt time and time again. Our life, for so much of the time, is a life of self-service as opposed to one of self-sacrifice to the King of Heaven. We traffic far more in self-indulgence than we do in self-denial. And therefore, we are upside down in debt. We already owed everything, and we have compiled the problem by digging deeper from the very first moment. And the only way that that debt can be paid, according to Scripture, is with our very lives. It's hard to see where there might be good news in this text, but it's there. You'll notice Jesus has no coin of his own to pull out of his pocket, no place to lay his head, according to the Gospels, no poor party to which he belongs that will side with him in this debate. He doesn't gain more popularity from this. He kind of just puts himself in no man's land. This one comes empty, and he does so because we who bear the image of God have marred it with our grasping lives. So what does the God who, to whom you owe everything do when he looks at you and he sees that you keep so much back for yourself? Does he storm the castle, rout the usurpers, plan an overthrow? No, he empties his pockets and sends forth a son who is his express image of the invisible God. And he spends him for you, so that you and I, by believing in him, can be restored to the very image of God. This Messiah wants you to know what is most important. And it's that God owns everything, and you owe God everything. And yet, knowing that you could not pay, He came and He paid that death in our place. So that you and I no longer have to have our identity wrapped up in the state or in politics or this or that issue, as if this is where life really takes place, or as if this issue is going to solve all the other issues of this world. God has placed us here as citizens of this nation, and it is a wonderful gift and blessing, and you should exercise all your rights as citizens to whatever end you feel is biblically most defensible. But when things don't go your way or when things are troubling, the question is fear or is anger the right response? Neither of those things show to whom we truly should be submitted, namely, the God of all creation, who directs all of history according to His perfect will. And therefore, we can rest well in His arms and give ourselves to Him fully, even in times of trouble or in areas where we can't seem to discern what good can come from it. He has set us free from the slavery of being joined to this age in order that we might be set free to the kind of slavery that issues forth into life and to joy and to peace everlasting. You see, much like in this text, I think we find it tempting to think that the hard thing must be to take the stance that would set us at edge in this way or that way. But the real hard thing is to give ourselves fully to God. Not to take a stand that gets half of the country on our side and the other half against us, whatever side that may be, but to take a stand where we're willing, much like Christ was, to say, I might lose both sides in standing for that which is most to be treasured, God Himself and His kingdom. May we set our sights there regardless of who wears the crown, knowing that our Lord is in the heavens and He does whatever He pleases. Let us pray.